Listen to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Okay, so we're live on Facebook, we're live on YouTube. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. I'm your host, Stel, and this young gentleman here, he's back from his birthday adventure.
I'm not even young anymore, am I?
Well, how old are you now?
34.
You're younger than me, so that means...
You said I was 31, didn't you? I liked you for like a couple of minutes, but yeah, anyway.
Oh, now he's getting brave, yeah? Oh, he's getting brave. Okay, well done. All right, so I'm going to introduce our guest tonight. Is once again, Mr. Rodri Giggs. How are you, Giggs? You all right?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Yeah. You okay, fellas? Yeah?
Good, Rodri.
Absolutely fine, absolutely fine. And making his long-awaited comeback to Shoot the Defence is the Daily Mirror's Adrian Kajumba. Adrian, welcome back to the show, my friend. Long time no see.
Thank you very much for having me back again.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. What have you been up to lately?
Oh, God, people ask me this, you know, and there's so much football going on at the moment. I can't even remember what I did. Actually, I'll need to remember what I did yesterday because I was at Brighton and you're going to ask me about that. But I can't remember what I did last week. Just going to matches here, there and everywhere, London, the South Coast, press conferences, just busy, 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 especially now the international break's over. It's football all the way through till March, so very busy at the moment.
Do you know what? I was actually going to ask you this a while back and I keep... forgetting, you do a lot of work with the England national team in terms of, you know, for the Daily Mirror and everything. Do you find it, I don't know how to ask this question, do you find it a little bit tedious when you have to, you know, correspond games against like Estonia one week and the next minute you're doing United Liverpool, for example?
I suppose in some senses you could say, yes, it is tedious because it's a long build-up for one game that you know England are going to win. But on the flip side of that, it's what everyone is talking about is England national team is still important. You know, they still get so much grief if they don't win games handsomely. So it's still a big topic. And ultimately, from our perspective, it's the biggest thing you can cover, the England national team. So there's that element to it as well, which keeps it interesting from my professional perspective.
Mm. Fair enough. It could be worse. You could be doing Scotland or Wales. No, Rod?
No comment. My wife will. No
comment. Is that a little dick there?
Yeah, listen, I'm just playing by the rules here. Right. Oh, right. Anyway, right, let's talk about the Premier League, shall we? And Saturday saw the first London derby this season, and in true derby fashion, the unfancied side took all 3 points. Now, Spurs have been in fine form as late, but they were no match for Arsenal's commitment, organisation, fluidity and attacking prowess. Now, goals from Mustafi and Sanchez gave Arsenal a deserved 2-0 win, while Mesut Ozil, who so often has been criticised for his performances in the big games, by you and Rod and... by me, was Arsenal's standout player. Now, Adrian, I know this was Arsenal's best performance of the season. I don't think anyone can deny this, which begs the question of why don't they actually show the same purpose, desire and urgency with the great solidarity, as Wenger said, every week?
Well, it's clearly not a question of ability because we saw what they did at the Emirates on Saturday. As you say, best display of the season, and it was pretty comprehensive. You know, Spurs had a couple of chances early on, but you know, Arsenal were convincing winners. So if it's not an issue of ability, it must be mentality. It must be attitude that they can't produce that level of performance week in, week out. And obviously, they got a lot of praise for that performance. I think a lot of that praise comes from the fact that many people expected Spurs to come to the Emirates and maybe do a job on them, continue showing how they're progressing and the sort of development curve that they're on. And I think that the fact that that didn't happen and Arsenal won, I think there's a lot of surprise and relief that's fueled some of these Arsenal celebrations. I'm not getting quite as excited as a lot of people because my question is along the lines of the question that you asked me. Why can't Arsenal do that every week? And that would be, you know, I've not been caught up in, oh, Arsenal was so great, you know, this shows they're still the top dogs in North London. I want to know why they don't perform like that every week, why Ozil isn't tracking back and running games as a player of his calibre should be doing. I want to know why that is not happening every week.
I think the interesting thing about the whole North London derby, from my perspective anyway, I think because Arsenal's social media presence and the amount of fans they've got, they're like the mafia, aren't they? Let's be brutally honest. And I think if Arsenal didn't put in a performance that the Arsenal fans were happy with, the players would have been crucified. I think that would have been the end of these Arsenal players, like your Ozils and all that kind of stuff, who've been, you know, constantly hounded by a lot of fans. I think that'd have been it for their Arsenal careers, even though the chances are Ozil and Sanchez will cut in the season. But speaking of Ozil, Rod, when you see him putting in man of the match performances like the one that he did at the weekend, it's got to remind us of how or why Arsenal actually spent that much amount of money to sign him. I mean, is there anyone out there better than him in that position?
Arguably no, but you know, it's like Adrian goes back to it, there's no consistency in that team, and that's why they'll never be a top team. Is there a better number 10, Mkhitaryan? No, joking aside, you know, Coutinho will be a good number 10. I don't think he's better than Coutinho. With Real Madrid, he's a top player, but you know, it's consistency. He had it at Real Madrid, but he seems to have lost it at Arsenal. But maybe, and he's not the only one in the team, so it's difficult. It's easy to get up for these big games, these derbies against Tottenham. The crowds, you know, it's lively. It's easy for top players to get up for that. But you know, top players with great attitudes, they perform every week, and that's not what he's not been able to do. That
I think what infuriates Arsenal fans is not Ozil's ability, it's off the ball. It's, you know, like City away, where he just doesn't want to run, doesn't want to track back. That's what Arsenal's problem has been with Ozil. Ability, he's probably up there with the very best. I mean, his record at Real Madrid and even at Arsenal assists and what he provides. There's no question about that. Especially,
but that tells me as well that the softness within the squad, because if you're a team player and you're on the pitch and you see that, you'd be in his ear telling him, come on, pull your finger out. And you'd be in the change room. So, and that doesn't seem to have happened because he's continued to do it in the smaller or lesser games.
Well, at Madrid, Rod, Mourinho, when he had him, he used to take him off after 70 minutes, nearly every game.
Yeah, so I remember that. Yeah, it was literally every game. I remember that, yeah.
So I don't know if it's a fitness issue or he gives his best for like 70 minutes and then he kind of runs out of fuel. But like I said,
Well, to me, that's just a silly argument. He's a professional footballer. If he's not fit, he shouldn't be in the job.
Yeah, I agree.
Call me harsh, but we talk about Ozil's ability and things like that. But I just find it hard to really, big up, for want of a better phrase, a player and talk about how good he is if you don't see it often enough.
Mm.
I really struggle with that. And I just think it's difficult to say how good Mesut Ozil is if you don't see it. I mean, it's one thing having the ability, but you've got to produce it. You've got to show it consistently.
He does it for Germany, though, to be fair, on the international stage.
But see, this is the thing. It must go back to attitude, then. Because he's done it everywhere he's been.
That's right.
Real Madrid, Schalke. Was it Werder Bremen?
Werder Bremen. It was Real Madrid. Well,
to me, he just clearly doesn't want to be there. He'll put in performance every now and again, but in his heart, he just doesn't want to be there.
There's a lot of talk about United as well, isn't there?
I mean, Lee from Arsenal Fan TV, that's on quite regularly. Mm. You know, he even said Ozil is playing for a shot window place.
Yeah. So is Sanchez.
Yeah, but Sanchez, come on, you know what you're going to get from him. How many times have you seen Sanchez shirking challenges or shirking anything? Mm. Ozil's a different...
They're different players, though. You can't, you know, Ozil's more luxury. Well, Sanchez gives more heart, I think. So.
Fair enough. Well, look, Spurs... you're a big, I wouldn't say you're a fan of Spurs, but you kind of like the way they play and that kind of stuff. Champagne football, anyway.
Yeah.
Their fans will point to the free kick given for the foul and Mustafi being, you know, a few inches offside. But yeah. I know it's all about fine margins, right? But did you actually see Spurs gain anything from the game, even before the goal,
no.
Given the way they're playing?
No? Not on Saturday, no. As you know, I kind of like the way that they play and their style and whatever else. But I just want to say, if that is a free kick in football, I'm not watching football anymore. That is ridiculous. If we're going to start giving free kicks for things like that, we might as well just pack up the game. It's a physical contact sport. How can you give a free kick for that? I just don't get it. He's trying to say he's pulled his shirt. From what angle? He's not even touched him. Anyway, that's irrelevant. That's another story. Regardless,
they still got to defend the free kick better.
Yeah, they've got to defend the free kick. They've got to put a lot more spirit, especially in the North London... a derby with, you know, the stakes as high, and you know they want to show everybody that they're kind of the top boys in London, and they failed. And to be fair, it's, you know, speaking to kind of Tottenham friends and whatever else, it's the third time they failed this season. I thought they were very poor at Old Trafford. United were there for the taking. Chelsea at home, yeah, you could argue maybe a draw might have been a fair result, but they lost that as well. there's going to come a point now where even someone like myself who praises their football, it's not about praising football anymore, it's about results. And it seems that in these kind of big games, Tottenham always seem to come short. And especially, like I said, in a game like that on Saturday where stakes are high, Arsenal, you know, even Arsenal were there for the taking as well, when they didn't really go for them. And Arsenal were brilliant on the day. I thought man-to-man, they were so much better. They were a lot quicker to the ball, physical challenges, they wanted it more. I think even tactically they were a lot better than Tottenham.
Yeah, but this
goes
back to what we say again about mentality. Who wanted it more?
Oh, Arsenal.
Because for me, Arsenal wanted it 100% more, 100 times more.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm talking about before, about Spurs. Like you mentioned mentality again.
Yep.
You know, I keep repeating myself over and over again, the times that they could have dug out points over the past few years when they were challenging for the title, when they didn't get these results. You know, you're looking at players like your Dele Alli's, your Harry Kane's, your Vertonghen's, that you need them to pull these performances out of their backsides. You know, I'm going to say it again. I would not be surprised if there is a mass exodus of Spurs either end of next season or the year after, because if Spurs do not win a trophy,
it's going to come a point where people are going to want to.
Of course,
100%.
Of course, and we hear so many times about the wage structure and how many times the players will, you know, want to, you know, Danny Rose.
Mm.
Talking about, you know, what did he say? Was it Daily Mirror they gave, or was it the Star they gave an interview? And he said, you know, I know how much
they questioned their transfer policy and didn't know some of the players they signed had to jump on Google. And obviously, the wages was a big issue, you know, not being paid his worth.
I'll tell you what, so I don't want to make excuses, but Alderweireld was a massive miss for them. He makes such a for me, he's one of the best center halves in the league.
But at the same time, yeah, I mean, if you look at that defensive line for the goal, there wasn't anything wrong with it.
Yeah,
it's just it was the actual defending itself was poor.
Yeah, and they've got the performance in there. Let's not forget they took 4 points off Real Madrid literally a month ago. So you know they're doing fantastic in the Champions League. It's just. Let's go back to that consistency level. They don't seem to have it this season.
That's right. It was marginal.
What I'd say about the Champions League games, Rodri, is the pressure issue. I think in the Premier League now, in these big games, certainly away from home, there's increasing focus on Spurs not winning these games. It's 1-17 now. I think they go into these league games with more and more pressure on them as everyone, you know, football fans across the country, look to see how this Spurs team is developing. Those Real Madrid games, home and away, pressure-free hits. I think everyone went into the
It's like they're beaten before they've even started, you know? If you think about it, if they're going into a big away game and their record is like 1-17, their mentality is probably like, well, if we get a draw, we'll be lucky, yeah?
Yeah, but they've got big-game players. They've got players that have played in European finals. Look at Lloris, he played in the European Championship final. You look at Vertonghen, he's won titles in Holland. You look at Alderweireld, he's been playing in the Premier League for years.
He won titles at Ajax as well, didn't he?
Do you know what I mean? Dembele's a good player. Mm-hmm. Wanyama's won titles in the SPL. Like, he's a physical player. Eriksen's a fantastic footballer.
Do you think it comes down to the manager, the fact that he hasn't got that winning mentality?
Listen, I'm not Pochettino's biggest fan, and I'll be the first one to get on his back. I think it is to do with him, but at the same time, you know, it's not just the manager's fault. It's the people that's on the pitch, you know. And that performance of the weekend was appalling. It was appalling. You know, you said Arsenal were there for the taking. I agree.
Mm.
I mean, this is one of the worst Arsenal teams I've seen for years.
It wasn't
back when John Jensen was playing with Glenn Helder.
Can you imagine the unrest at Arsenal if Tottenham went to the Emirates and would have?
That's
won.
What I'm saying.
You know, Tottenham would have been on the high, and you know, like I said, it was a perfect opportunity for Tottenham, and they blew it.
Mm. Yeah. Let's move on, shall we? Right. So Arsenal's win moved them within a point of Spurs in fourth place, and three behind Chelsea, whose 4-0 win at West Brom was the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back for the Baggies' board. As Tony Pulis became managerial casualty number 5, Cinco, isn't it, in the Premier League this season. Now, Adrian, if you look at the length of time De Boer had at Palace, I guess you've got to give West Brom some credit for giving Pulis a bit of time to turn it around. But 7 losses, 4 draws from the last 11 games, mate, is pretty bad. And the performances, especially Saturdays, have been abysmal, haven't they?
And they have been patient, because obviously Pulis lost his job, not just because of this season, but you know, the back end of last season as well. He's got this kind of track record of getting his teams to 40 points and then they're just completely dropping off. Happened last year. And in total, I think the results are 2 wins in 21 games. So you know, that's 10 at the back end of last year as well. So they have been patient. They have given him time to try and turn things around. They gave him, obviously, a decent amount of money to spend, or some money to spend in the summer. And on top of that, they gave him the international break as well. you know, and they gave him this extra game, you know, after the international break against Chelsea. And then, as you say, it was just one result, one poor result and poor performance, too many.
Adrian, how many points do you think teams will need to stay up this season? Because we hear about the 40 points, as you mentioned. Do you think it's going to be more because there isn't a Sunderland to go down? Is there all three places to go for?
Yeah, but then that, you know, that in some ways means it's going to be a little bit tighter down the bottom. Teams taking points off each other, and in some ways that can then lower the points needed as well because there are more teams in it. I mean, we say 40. I think that's kind of dropped a little, you know, in more recent times, and you're looking at maybe 36 can be enough to keep you up and get out of trouble, and that maybe being the benchmark.
That's right. It's going to be tighter at the bottom than it is at the top, no doubt.
Certainly, I mean, City looks like everyone's playing for second at the moment. I suppose the one thing you have to, I suppose, hope if you're in the chasing pack, you know, as much as you don't wish injuries on somebody, but it's just to see how injuries affect City. Yes, Mendy was a big miss, but I'm not sure we totally got to see exactly what he was going to bring to City because he was injured so soon. But missing Stones in an area where, you know, Company is also, you know, such an important player, but clearly his track record shows that he's not going to be available every week. So if they got to keep chopping and changing, certainly for the next 6 weeks, while, you know, we're expecting Stones to be out with his hamstring problem, that could just disrupt them a little bit as well.
That's right.
I hope so.
Yeah, they're all guns blazing at the moment, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Rod, according to several reports, Tony is the front runner for the Wales job after Chris Coleman resigned to take the helm at Sunderland. Would you be happy to see Mr. Pulis in charge?
It's difficult to say because, you know, touch on like Adrian said, they seem to get to that 40-point mark and the teams seem to switch off. So I don't know how good he would be as a... Obviously, you know, he's good at sorting defences out and keeping it tight, and then you've got the X factor Gareth Bale. So maybe it would work. He's got the experience. He's certainly got the experience, and I think, you know, he's probably the best man for the job at the minute, who's out there, and he's Welsh, so that's the added bonus.
Mm. The thing is, you often hear about Sam Allardyce being tipped for these jobs kind of thing, and then they're like, oh, you know, he's one of those managers that could get, you know, out of relegation zones, and that's the same with Tony Pulis. But Pulis has never really had a world star to coach like Gareth Bale, has he? I can't think. Stoke, did he have any world-class players? I can't remember. West Brom, sure as hell, didn't. So
it just becomes a situation with, obviously, Gareth Bale's situation with not being fit every week. If he misses games, then what's going to be the plan B? You know, you've obviously got some not world class players, but, you know, top players in Aaron Ramsey and, you know, a couple others. But it's still very thin. If Gareth Bale and a couple others are out, then what's his plan B?
So, as a Welshman yourself, would the ideal candidate have to be Welsh? Because if, for example, let's say, I don't know, Ronald Koeman, he's out of job at the moment. If he was offered the job, would you be happy with him or someone else?
Well, arguably, really, you'd want the best man for the job. If he's Welsh, that's an added bonus. But, you know, they're not really out there. So, it's a difficult one. But ideally, you want someone who's Welsh, but... You know, obviously, being realistic, if you get a top manager and you can't complain.
Bellamy wants the job, doesn't he?
Who?
Craig Bellamy.
Does he?
Yeah, he put himself in the frame. He wants the job.
Oh, I think...
On TV, like Craig Bellamy, very passionate.
Yeah, very.
Like, talking about his awareness of the young Welsh players coming through, and he thought that'd be important, the nationality side of things. Obviously, Craig Bellamy has got... I think he's done some coaching, possibly at Cardiff, I think.
That's right. He's there with Warnock, can he?
Yeah, he does the under-18s, I think.
Limited coaching and managerial experience, but, you know, in the absence of a top manager, maybe if Pulis isn't going to win everyone over, would Bellamy be a bit more of a popular appointment, possibly?
You know, to be honest, gents, appointing a head coach for a national team that's never had any coaching experience at any level, it doesn't sit right with me. You know, and especially for a nation like Wales, who, let's be honest, they're going through some form of transitional period at the moment, because you've got a lot of players coming to the back end of their careers at the moment, haven't you? You know, with Williams and all that kind of stuff. But then you've got Bale and Ramsey, so you've got a bit of a mixture there. It's the same with the Republic of Ireland, in the sense that, you know, who can they call upon? There aren't any...
There's not a lot.
There aren't, like, you haven't got your Townsends, your McGraths, your... All those players.
Stapletons and
whatever. I think, well, as you're looking at the, you know, it's early in their careers, but I think that next generation that Chris Coleman has blooded is going to be quite exciting for them over the next few years, because they're getting in the side already. Ben Woodburn and the impact he had in the qualification campaign. Ethan Ampadu's at Chelsea played last week against Panama. I think they both, him and David Brooks, were involved as well at Sheffield United. So there is a crop of players who I think they're the type of players who Bellamy was referring to, saying he was aware of. So you would imagine if he was to get the job, those guys would keep progressing and keep getting chances. So, you know, beyond Bale and Ramsey, there are players for Wales to sort of hang a future on. It's just maybe moulding that all together. You know, those guys in the middle, Bale and Ramsey, the older crop and this young crop, you know, coming through, trying to merge that all together into one team that's able to produce results now.
It definitely bring a lot of passion. Craig Bellamy, he'll wear his heart on his sleeve.
I think he'd be good as a number two.
Yeah.
No, you obviously, like a Pulis and Craig Bellamy, I think that would be kind of a good mix with experience, with that bit of passion, and, you know, and they're both Welsh, but we'll just have to wait and see. But yeah, I agree with Stel. It does need to be an experienced manager. You can't go into a top international job with no experience in being a manager.
It's like Roy Keane, he's got the number two job with the Republic of Ireland. You know, again, you know, I'll just repeat what I said, like you said, Roy. Having a manager to coach a national team, I know the Dutch did it with Rijkaard and Van Basten, but let's be honest, they had a transitional period, and it was a big transition when Rijkaard got the job in Van Basten. But, you know, as you said, with Wales, they need the guy there that knows the ropes. It doesn't have to have international experience, but to have experience at the top level, like the Premier League. I think Pulis would be perfect. I think Mark Hughes would be a good shout.
Yeah, I think Mark Hughes, yeah.
What about Big Sam? He's had it with England. He's had a taste.
As a Welshman, I wouldn't be happy with him. Not one bit.
Why not? Because of the team or any other reason?
Just the way he plays football, and just his background and the stuff that he's been through with England. I just wouldn't like him. I just wouldn't like him being a Wales manager.
But Rod, to be fair, mate, Pulis has been criticised for his style of play, and, you know, is his style much different?
To me, it's just that he's English and he's not Welsh. That's basically it. It's just he's English and he's not Welsh.
Well, listen, you could be worse. You could get Dean Saunders, I guess.
I don't think we'll get Dean Saunders.
Get Toshak back.
John Toshak, yeah? Okay. Right. Fair enough. What have you been smoking, mate?
I'm not telling you.
Enough of that, mate. Right. Chris Coleman, his decision to quit the Wales national team and join Sunderland was met with mixed views. I don't feel his career is over, as they call it, career suicide. While others believe Cookie can drag Sunderland out of the mire. Now, for our bite back, we actually asked our Facebook group page what they thought of Coleman's new venture, and we got a lot of answers. So, gentlemen, brace yourselves. Ban starts off with, "I'm surprised he opted for the Sunderland job. If we are to believe the media, there is a problem behind the scenes. I thought he'd done enough with Wales to be more careful in where he goes." Now, Rick said Coleman should have waited. The West Ham job might be available soon. Moyes bashing already. Right, Enzo Mizuraco, who's an Italian that's licking his wounds at the moment, said, "Surely a money-orientated move and nothing more." Lee Bray, a good friend of mine who is a Spurs fan, says, "Where managers go to die is Sunderland, but still got to be better than managing Wales." So, Lee, why do you have to say that? Right, Dan DeLuca says, "Surprising. I guess he's looked at that Sunderland can't get any worse, so it's an easy job in that respect. He'll keep them up, buy in the summer, not kick on, and be set next October with Sunderland around 16th. I can't just see that happening, to be honest. Ben Burnell, a big Wales fan, says, "Massive step down. The only reason I can see is for money. And he gets paid bugger all as Wales manager. Bring Pulis in to replace him." There you go.
There we go.
Yeah, and Mr. Pieri, I don't know what Mike's been up to lately. I think he's coaching Spurs at the moment. He says he can't lose, can he? Tripled his salary. If he succeeds, he's a genius. If he fails at a club that's rotten to the core, There you go. No problem. He's always stuck. Struck me as a sensible but supremely competent person. So I'm not surprised he's taken this job. Reminds me of when I was manager of Barnet during the. Why are you talking about championship manager? Right. And Pascal Gibonda, the voice of reason. He swapped working with players who fight for the shirt and want to be with the group, even if they're injured, to a dressing room where no one is bothered aside from collecting their payslips. At least he can't do any worse. Then who? Simon Grayson or David Moyes? I don't know. Gents, what are your views? What about you? What do you reckon? Chris Coleman, is he walking the tightrope already? Career suicide?
Yeah, I think so.
Really?
I think he's taken a big chance for his reputation there, to be honest.
Yep.
You know, for what he did at Wales, he took a lot of credit. You know, of course, you know, every Welshman loves him for what he did and what he achieved. To go to Sunderland, if it goes really kind of bad and really passionate, it could damage his reputation. I am surprised. I think there were better clubs out there for him. But, like, I actually agree with Mike. He's kind of in a no-lose situation. Because if he turns it around, oh, look, he's done it at Sunderland as well. Look where they were and what he's done. If he doesn't, it's behind the scenes. There's a problem at Sunderland. It's not the manager's fault. So he might just walk away with it without kind of being mentioned. But I still think there were better jobs out there for Chris Coleman.
Adrian, forgive me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Chris Coleman head coach of Coventry City at some point before he got the Wales national team job?
Oh, I can't remember, actually. I can't remember exactly where he was, but...
Was it Sociedad?
Okay, well, I'm pretty sure he had the Coventry City role. I don't know why I'm saying Coventry City, but what do you think he's going to do at Sunderland, mate? Because they've got problems, haven't they? I mean, they lost, what, 16, 17 players in the summer?
They have, yeah, and it's not won a home game in 20, I think it is, which is the worst record in English league football ever. So, I mean, there's a lot to sort out there. What was surprising me a little bit about this one is, regardless of how much you think his success at Wales is purely down to having Gareth Bale at the absolute peak of his powers, what he did with Wales, in my view, was you know, big feather in the cap for Chris Coleman, and probably gave him more options than Sunderland, I would have thought, for his first job back in club management after that. Obviously, we've seen how Tony Pulis has gone at West Brom. Might he have been a name in the frame for that if his situation wasn't resolved? Swansea, you know, there are issues at his former club, Swansea, with Paul Clement. Could he have possibly held on to see whether, you know, he might have been in the running for that? So he's possibly moved a bit early, but at the same time, you know, just in the industry I work, I do know that managers, agents they're on the phone to clubs, you know, inquiring about their clients and jobs that are coming up. So maybe they knew, and maybe this ended up just being that even if they had put a call into Swansea or West Brom, Chris Coleman might not have been in the running for those jobs. So Sunderland ends up being, timing-wise, the best vacancy available to him.
Mm. Well, Chris Coleman has managed Fulham, Real Sociedad, Coventry City, and Larissa in Greece. He was only there for a year for that. And to be honest, I'm not going to go on the guy's back because, you know, a head coach in Greece got sacked after 11 days at the beginning of the season. So I'm not going to judge him on that one. But Rod, when you heard the news, were you surprised? I mean, we knew that he wanted a club team, but Sunderland?
listening to on the radio yesterday, on the local radio here, it just sounded like he's obviously doubled his money, which is not bad, obviously, personally. But he sees Sunderland as a massive club. He's an old types kind of person. And he sees Sunderland as a massive club. And he wants a challenge, and he thinks he can do it. He's obviously had assurances that he's going to have money to bring players in, or, you know, he's going to be in trouble. And it's going to be difficult for him because, you know, they've obviously not got a decent group there by what Darren Gibson was reporting a few months ago. So... You know, there's obviously a few rats in the camp, so he needs to get them out, get them together. He can obviously do that. He did a good job at Fulham when he had a time at Fulham, and he had a bit of money at Fulham. And he did a good job at Wales getting the group together. Obviously, yeah, he had Gareth Bale as an X factor, but, you know, he's got a tough job, but he sees it as a challenge, and he thinks he's exciting to do that. So you've got to give props to him, but it's going to be difficult for him.
I think Mike is right. He's in a win-win situation, isn't he? I mean, the attendances at Sunderland have been poor for years. If he gets asses in seats, then that's a thing. If he turns them around and starts getting... I don't know if you saw the Millwall game at the weekend. The goals
Oh, yeah. Oh, they were atrocious.
It was like watching Benny Hill. Yeah, honestly, it's like watching a carry-on. Yeah. That's how bad the
goalkeeping, especially. Oh my god!
Yeah,
you're right.
Well, he's an experienced manager. He's been managing now for at least 15 years, so you know he's obviously got to go in there and get the group all going in the right direction, and obviously get a few players in January, and then, you know, you can only go up at that club at the minute.
Started with a defeat tonight as well. They lost 2-1 to Villa.
That's a difficult start for him, but obviously he's had probably 1 or 2 days on the training ground with him. Mm. He's obviously assessed him, and then he'll probably get to work tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right, moving on. It's as you were at the top of the Premier League. City maintained their 8-point lead after having beaten Leicester 2-0 away. United saw the return of Pogba and Ibrahimovic and came back from behind to beat Newcastle 4-1. Meanwhile, not a million miles from Manchester, Burnley continued their great start to the season, beating Swansea 2-0. Now, Adrian, it's very difficult to ignore how well Burnley are doing at the moment, mate. Although it's only a matter of time before the wheels come off, and that's probably when Dyche gets the Everton job, or, I don't know, Sunderland, anyway. What do you make of their start to the season?
Well, it goes without saying, it's excellent. They're at the seventh in the table, and I think, you know, one of the most impressive things about Burnley this year for me has been the way they've rectified the sort of problem away from home that they had last year. We didn't win a game at home until, you know, right towards the end of the season when I went to Palace. This year they've already got 3 away wins on the board, and that's just a sign of positive progression that they're making under Sean Dyche. You know, we talked about Tony Pulis and maybe why things started to unravel for him at West Brom, and it's pretty much because they weren't going anywhere. They'd start the season knowing they were going to stay up, they weren't going to challenge any higher, they were just going to be in that mid bracket of teams. Well, Burnley, like, you know, as their time in the Premier League continues, they're actually improving. And for a fan, that's what you want to see. You want every year to see your team developing, learning lessons, improving, climbing the table. Yes, Burnley will hit a ceiling. That may come soon. That may come at the end of the season. But, I mean, from what they've done so far at the start of the season, to 5th and 7th, from the sort of money they spend, the sort of players they bring in, it's unbelievable, and huge credit to Sean Dyche.
Hey, have you ever had any dialogue with Sean Dyche?
No, I mean, I predominantly cover the clubs down in London and the South Coast, so Burnley don't often come across my I was actually at that game against Crystal Palace last year when they won that first away game, but I was dealing with the players after the game today, so not had too many dealings with Sean Dyche. He's quite a straight guy from the couple of times I've seen him. He's got a bit of a sense of humour about him, but I don't know him too well. I'm not too familiar with him as a person or anything like that.
I mean, the reason I ask is because he does seem like a guy that's very endearing and very charismatic, and you can see why Burnley are doing so well with him. Obviously, it's been a gradual process because they were down, came back up again. But for him to bring them back up and to make them play so, I mean, Chris Wood has been absolutely fantastic. I mean, I can't say one player has stood out at Burnley, because as a team, as a collective, they've been absolutely fantastic. Hence the reason why I asked about Sean Dyche, because I'm not going to get on this bandwagon to say he's like the next best thing, whatever. But you can tell that he's one of these coaches where he will step into a club, he'll get the players on side, and he'll get them believing in him and his philosophy.
Can I say something?
Say what you want.
You know, when we talk about managerial casualties, you have to give Burnley credit as well.
The fact
that they kept faith with him and believed in what he was going to do. Yeah, they went down, but look what he's done since then. Took them back up, which is different. Everyone knows you go back down from the Premiership.
I think they're the projects at the time as well, where, you know, they were putting money in, instead of putting money into big players, they were revamping, they've got a new training ground, you know, everything's Premier League now, and now he's made him into a Premier League team.
But he's invested wisely, he's made a lot of tactical decisions that, you know, have been frowned upon from a defensive perspective.
It was someone like Jack Cork.
Of course, he's
brilliant signing. Yeah. You know, he's done really well. Like you said, Chris Wood, he's getting the best out of these players, not spending
and that. And they've made money with Michael Keane and other players down the line.
Yep. And he actually he had Joey Barton on the leash, didn't he?
Yeah.
He decided to get the mobile app out and started, you know, betting. Less about said about that, the better. Right, Pog back, kebab boy out. Happy days, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, you love Mkhitaryan, don't you? Favourite player, innit?
Like a hole in the head.
I think I know I'm going to get you for Christmas, Mkhitaryan shirt. Well, that's another story.
Bugger off.
It was frightening, though, still, to be honest. Until United scored, I mean, Newcastle looked good. They looked comfortable. They won 1-0 up. Could have made it 2 with Murphy. And then, thank God, the quality kind of paid off. The goal before half-time by Martial, and then obviously Smalling 2-1 at half-time, made it a lot easier in the second half, and United played well second half. But like you said, Pogba, he makes a massive difference to Man United. He gets a lot of stick because of his, you know, the price tag that United paid and whatever else. But you can tell when he plays how much the team excels. I mean, it's not a coincidence that at the start of the season he was in the team and United were playing differently and scoring goals. And then since he's been missing, we've all seen what kind of performances United have put in. It comes back on Saturday. Yeah, all right, Newcastle are not the greatest sides in the Premiership, but you still beat and play what's in front of you. And the fact that he makes United tick and makes the others play a lot better as well. I mean, his range of passing outside of the 40, he was playing 40, 50-yard pass. He was controlling the middle of the park. Matic can just sit there and protect the back four as well. And then he allows the other two guys to bomb forward and play, which that's what kind of every United fan wants to see. So it was positive. I'm not going to get too carried away. Like I said, it was Newcastle. But the fact that he was back and playing that the way that it was was big for me.
I agree. And Rodri, Lindelof got a lot of stick for his slip that made Dwight Gayle's job a bit easier. He needs time, though, doesn't he, man? I don't think it's fair to judge him after 4 months at the club, is it?
No, he's done okay since he's come in. Obviously, his slip, that can happen to anyone. You know, I think that was the first goal they've let in at Old Trafford, so he's not doing that bad. All right, he's not played some of them games, but you know, as a defensive unit and as squad players, as defenders, all you want to do is keep clean sheets and obviously nick a goal here and there. So he's done okay. He's got a big price tag, but we've seen it before. When Vidic come, Evra come, it took 6 months, 12 months for them to settle in. And once they've settled in, they turned out to be fantastic players. So there's still time, you know. I still don't think he knows his best back four. Now Rojo's back. He'll be up for that position. So, you know, he's got a good situation at the minute, Mourinho, because he's not letting in goals, and he's got a variety of top players, well, adequate top players to choose from.
I think he's protecting Lindelof well, Mourinho, to be honest. Yeah, we all know he's not had the greatest starts at United, but he's choosing the games to play him, and he's kind of feeding him in slowly into the Premiership and what it's all about. Is that stick at United this season, because he's not started well? But like you said, 4 months, you can't judge him on 4 months. You know, give him a year at least and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. I think, well, I'm hoping it will come good. So,
well, the first real mistake he made was at Huddersfield. But let's be honest, who turned up in that game?
Nobody.
Who did?
Nobody.
Who did?
Only Matic.
So, exactly, right. Day, so. And then you're looking at the slip. As Rod said, it could happen to anyone. But Rod mentioned something just a bit earlier, in the sense that Mourinho doesn't know his best back four. Mm. Lindelof has played with Bailly, with Jones and Smalling. So it's not as if he's been able to develop any sort of relationship with another central defender. Look, I'm not one of these people where I'm going to be like, oh yeah, you know, he's one of the best defenders in the league. He does need time to develop. But, you know, he came with a big price tag. It's a different league. It's a different kettle of fish. Adrian, what do you make of Lindelof anyway? We saw him for Sweden against Italy. He was phenomenal, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was, yes. I mean, so far from what I've seen of him, I can understand the concerns. I think even if you go back to pre-season, I don't know if you saw much of Man United's pre-season, but I think it was the Real Madrid game where he gave away a penalty, I think. I think it was Real Madrid.
It was Real Madrid.
He gave away a penalty with just...
He smashed the defender.
He's one of the most bizarre tackles you'd ever see from a 30 million defender, even a professional defender, so late, just wiped somebody out. And he's just not really inspired any confidence. I understand completely the Vidic and the Evra comparisons and the need to give him time. But, you know, football's different now. Players are judged so much quicker now. You've got social media, everyone's got their opinion. Everything's instant. And it just feels like every game he's doing something. He's making a mistake. Sometimes costly, sometimes not, but it just seems he's always involved in them. And
I think as a centre half partnership, you know, we've always seen it down in the past. We need to centre halves like to have a partnership and play every week and get to know it and be comfortable. When you're switching and swapping, it, you know, it can be difficult. But like Adrian says, you know, times are changing now, and he has to adapt, and he has to adapt quickly.
I just think
that whole partnership idea is difficult, because at Manchester United, it seems none of them can stay fit. for any sort of extended period of time. I mean, Baye's managed to do it the longest, but even he twice now, I think he's on his second kind of layoff. It's really difficult. I mean, Baye's obviously the number one defender at Manchester United, centre-back-wise. He's been a great purchase. But, you know, even he's not quite managed to be there every single week. So it's difficult to stick by, Lindelof alongside somebody regularly, it seems.
I think it's difficult, but what I'm trying to get at is, if we've seen it with Phil Jones, where we've played him in different positions, where now he's just played him in centre-half and we've seen reaping the rewards with his performance. If Lindelof playing right-back, then centre-half, I think he's, if he's centre-half, playing centre-half, he's a right-back, just playing right-back and getting used to the team. And obviously, hopefully he'll improve.
Yeah. I just think it's one of them things with Lindelof at the moment. The fact that kind of, you know, the eyes on him and everyone's watching him. It's like the slip the other day. It's unfortunate. But because it's him and the money that United have paid, and he was back in the team, it was the first goal United conceded. It's Lindelof, you know, the spotlight's on him. I think he'll come good. I think he's got a strong mentality. And now he's got Ibrahimovic there as well, which, you know, they're both Swedish. So he can help him and get him through it. So, I do agree with Adrian, though. I think he's got mistakes in him, and that's worrying. Even though it's still early, I can see he looks a bit clumsy and a bit nervous.
I think it's the nerves, mate.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, football's ruthless now. You know, like Adrian said, you haven't got time now. It's, you know, he's in the team. He might not be in the team for 2-3 months if he carries on like that. That's how, and especially
I agree.
Got about 4 or 5 centre-halves there as well.
How many times have you seen any kind of footballer that's had a horrible start to his career? Look at Gareth Bale, for example, at Spurs. He was this close to being sold to Birmingham, and then something just happened, clicked.
And they're going to win a game with Bale in the team, could they?
Exactly.
Mm. And another one sprung to my mind, David De Gea, who really struggled. Very, you know, obviously very different position, goalkeeper compared to our football player. Mm. But, you know, he had the same adaptation to English football problems. And look at him now. You watch him now. the trouble at the start.
And hopefully, if Mourinho having a year under Mourinho, we've seen it with Rojo when he come back. He was a bit of a calamity, and then he seemed to turn it around until he got his injury. So we'll just have to wait and see.
That's right. Well, Adrian, you were there to witness Brighton equalise twice against Stoke last night. The Seagulls are up to ninth on the table. Great start to the season for them, isn't it?
It is a great start. I'm looking at their record now. Four wins, 4 draws, 4 defeats, 16 points on the board after 12 games. I'm sure Chris Hughton would have taken that. My one, not issue, because it's difficult to have an issue with a newly promoted side, but it could have been even better. Last night, they were very unlucky with a penalty decision. Glenn Murray, you know, everyone's seen it. Ryan Shawcross's tackle, it was a penalty. But, you know, it's 3 undraws in a row, and obviously a newly promoted side, that tends to be where they're going to pick up most of their points. They drew with Southampton in a game where they didn't quite push to get that winner. Obviously, Rooney's late penalty. Rooney's late penalty in the Everton game obviously denied them all 3 points. And then last night, it could just be. I mean, it's a great start, and it could be even better. You know, they got a really tough run coming up now, starting with Manchester United the weekend. I think they got Chelsea in there, Tottenham, Liverpool as well, and Crystal Palace next Tuesday. Actually, coming up in their sort of next 10 games, running up to. December the 30th, you know, it's around the turn of the year, so even better, you know, if they'd had you know, 4 more points, they're going on, you know, 20 points going into that really difficult run, it could be even better for them.
That's right. And gents, Everton's Umar Nias is being charged for successful deception of a match official by the FA after supposedly diving to win a penalty in the 2-2 draw with Crystal Palace. Now, personally, I actually believe the referee made the right decision to give the penalty, but what do you guys make of the referee's decision and the news of Nias's FA charge? Retrospective action, mate.
It's a difficult one.
You don't like the VAR technology.
No, I absolutely despise it with a passion. I don't agree with it at all. I think the referee's there to do his job. If it's a pen, it's a pen. If it's not,
it's like this, yeah. Did he dive for a start?
It's a matter of opinion, because...
Okay, what's your opinion?
Your
then?
Opinion is a pen, right? The FA have looked at it and charged him for diving. So, who's right?
I'm asking you. I'm not asking the FA, I'm asking you.
I think it was a dive.
You thought it was a dive? So, should he be banned retrospectively?
Well...
But I'm asking you a question. Don't sit on the fence. You got splinters on your ass. Come on.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, if that's where football's going now, where if you're going to cheat to earn a penalty and it is a dive, then yeah, there has to be some form of action, because you can't, you know, dive and get away with it. And and earn points for your team if that's the case. But
if I'm playing a football game and I tackle someone and it's a fair tackle and they dive and they get a penalty and score the winner and then get the 3 points, but he gets banned 2 weeks later, I don't really care about that. So yeah, that's not being punishment. The punishment, if they're going to do video technology, they should do it there and then. But that's a different argument.
No,
I think with a retrospective ban, the idea is to make it a deterrent. Niasse possibly get banned for 1-2 games and never ever want to do it again because of what he's missed these 2 games. Fully appreciate exactly what you're saying. He still gets a penalty. Leighton Baines still scores. Everton still get a point. But this is just, in the absence of video technology for now, this is the way they're looking at it. And you'd hope that even if it's just one player, Niasse getting banned, that will put everyone off doing it and taking the risk, really.
So was it a pin in your eyes, Aid?
Was it a penalty? No. There was a little bit of contact, but he made a massive meal of it. Massive, massive meal of it.
And are you for the FA charge?
Yeah, I am for the FA charge. And I'm also for the idea of trying to do something to stamp out. For a long time, we've just talked about it. So this is the way they've tried to attack the problem. So let's see if it does act as a deterrent. Let's see if diving offences and cautions for diving drop this year. What I do find quite strange, actually, what I will say is, it seems that, if I remember correctly, you only dealt retrospectively if it leads to a penalty. It's not just all diving across the pitch. It has to be one that wins a penalty, I believe, and possibly maybe a free kick. I can't remember exactly, but it's limited. It's not a case of diving anywhere on the pitch.
So it has to affect the scoreline in some way.
And I think it should have been something that was brought in as a blanket sort of offence. Almost like a review panel would be very busy on a Monday reviewing all the potential dives over the course of a weekend. But I think, that's probably the way to go at trying to stamp it out.
I'll ask a question. For the fact for the FA to review that, does that mean that the referee has put in his report that he's got it wrong and that was a dive and he wasn't a pen?
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
A question that I don't have the answer to because I don't have the referee's report.
As I said, I think it's because it leads to a penalty, it's then looked at.
Yeah, but because the referee's seen it and given it, it's like a red card, isn't it? It's like a yellow card. If the referee sees the incident and he books the player, nothing else happens by the FA afterwards because the referee's seen it. It's only if the referee doesn't see it and the FA acts and will give like a free match ban, like the Zlatan stamp on Taremi's, whatever. But the fact that he's seen the incident, he's given a pen. So what, the FA have actually reviewed that and gone, well, actually, that's a dive and he deserves to be banned. Or I'd like to know if it was that actually the referee thinks that he's actually made the mistake himself and the FA have viewed it or reviewed it.
This happened in the first half, didn't it?
After, what, 5 minutes, wasn't it?
Yeah. Happened in the first half. Yeah. So obviously the referee's had time to see the incident at half time. So he probably did put in his report.
Yeah, I'd assume so.
And he's probably had players surrounding him at half time, or you just never know. Mm. Rodri, what do you reckon? Is this... Is this the right way to go about it?
Well, like Adrian said, you've got to start somewhere, and obviously this is what they're starting at. So we'll obviously see if it works. But I was almost every single manager that I ever played for. If you get touched in the box, you go down. It's just as simple as that. You don't dive. If you get touched, you go down. But if you play a dive, you just tell him no, we don't do that. It's a fine line, though. It's very difficult for referees, obviously, because it's a slight touch and he's gone down. He's made a meal of it, but he's been touched, and so therefore it's a penalty.
Fair enough. Okay, there you go. Sorted. Right, let's quickly move on to the Champions League because there are a few games tonight. Man City won, Spurs won at Dortmund, Liverpool threw away a 3-0 lead. Happy days. It's a really much else. Okay, listen, there's going to be a massive, like, I don't know, there's going to be an autopsy about Liverpool's defending again because they threw away a 3-goal lead. Again, Klopp rung the changes. He brought in Karius in goal. He put Alexander-Arnold on the bench. Adrian, with the greatest respect to Liverpool, I don't mean to bash them again. I'm going to try and keep this as toned down as possible, but you cannot win trophies with defending like that, can you, honestly?
No, you can't. And the one thing that's baffled me about Liverpool and their defensive situation is Jurgen Klopp was desperate to bring in Virgil van Dijk in the summer. A minimum £60 million defender, possibly higher. Certainly, went, you know, his price tag went up after the issues they got themselves into with Southampton. Now, if you want a player of that valuation, that's a clear sign to me that you've identified that position as a key one to strengthen. So to go after Van Dijk, not get that done, and not have a plan B is baffling to me. And to be starting games with Ragnar Klavan, Lovren,
Matip,
and the other options they've got, it's just one of a few problems actually Klopp has just not solved in his time at Anfield.
The thing is, was Van Dijk their only option? I mean, I know it's easy for us to say that he was, because that was the player that they, you know, it was well documented that they were after. But I can't believe that a manager of Klopp's experience, having won the Bundesliga, having guided Dortmund to a Champions League final, having taken Liverpool to a Europa League final, you know, didn't he win a domestic trophy as well in Germany? So for a guy that's actually been there and done it to some extent, for him to only put all his eggs in one basket, I can't believe that. I'm struggling to believe. Well,
on top of what I said about Van Dijk, he actually then came out towards, I think, the end of towards the end of the period before the season started, and said, "You can look across Europe; there won't be five better defenders than the ones we've got." So we don't even have to really guess that Van Dijk was his only option. He's come out and said something like that, which only just adds to the whole the bizarreness and the kind of. The bafflement that you feel about this situation is crazy.
I agree. I mean, even after Van Dijk, there weren't any rumours about Liverpool signing a centre-half. I don't remember any name coming out saying that after Van Dijk, Liverpool going to sign somebody else. I can't think of one.
Just to twist it a little bit, to flip it. Do you think he's under some pressure to play youngsters because of the whole thing with Melwood and the ban that they have? For poaching players, do you think he's playing the likes of Gomez and all these other youngsters because he feels the board have told him he has to?
No,
no,
he's playing them because he's got no choice, because what he's got are not good enough, in my opinion. Because if that was the case, he would start playing Solanke or whatever else. He's not playing him. He's playing his experienced players up front. I just think because defensively they're so bad. Like Gomez is a good player, and he's getting and Arnold Trent is a good player, and he's getting their chances because they're not good enough in that area. And if Klein came back after injury, Klein will play. So I don't think it's the youngster issue there at all. I just think they're not good enough.
Fair enough. And Spurs, Rod won at Fraudmund. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised. No, because the Spurs have been fantastic in the Champions League, and Dortmund aren't the powers they used to be. So. They seem to be performing in the Champions League, so it might be their year, but no, they've obviously qualified, and that's no mean feat, that, especially in a group with Real Madrid.
And I say this with a wry smile. Apoel, they got a tonking, didn't they?
That's a Ramone hat on, isn't it?
Yeah,
they did. It's good to see Ronaldo back on the score sheet. Being biased, he hasn't scored for that 7-8 games.
And Benzema scored.
Benzema scored as well. So yeah, poor Cypriots, isn't it? If you want to end the gold drought, go to Cyprus.
This is about that. That's what I think. Right. In other news, Valencia's eighth win in a row moved them up to second in La Liga, 4 points behind Barcelona after a poor draw in the Madrid derby. My mate, 18 months ago, Gary Neville was doing his level best to overtake David Moyes and Chris Coleman for the most pathetic attempt by a Brit coach to coach in Spain. Now, fast forward to the present. Marcelino's come in from Villarreal. He sold 16 players and turned Simone Zaza into the most informed striker in Europe. What a turnaround.
Have you seen his goals?
I have, yes.
Oh my good God. This is the same player that was at West Ham.
Yeah.
I just can't believe it. I mean, it just shows sometimes as well with confidence and a team playing a certain style of football. It is the most exciting Valencia team I have seen for a while. They've got some good players. There's Santi Mina, Rodrigo's doing the business, Zaza, as you know, Parejo in midfield. They're a good side, and their record speaks for it. So I think they're the only club challenging Barcelona. They're four points behind them, and Real Madrid kind of don't know what's happened to them this season. Well, that's another story. But us, even defensively, Valencia, they're not ever been time for being, apart from, like, you know, the Ayala days. Even defensively, they're not conceding a lot of goals. And it's good to see, because Valencia are one of them clubs that you kind of like them doing well, because they play a certain style of football and their fan base is quite good and whatever else. But can they sustain it for another season? I'm not sure. I don't think they're good enough to win the title, but they're certainly on merit at the moment, good enough to challenge and be up there, and they're certainly exciting to watch.
Well, they've got a financial backing a start.
Yeah.
The only problem that they've got at the moment is that they've got two stadiums. They've got the Mestalla, which they can't sell. Yeah. They've got the new one, which they're obviously paying off.
Even United's Pereira's doing well there as well. And Guedes from PSG, they've got him on loan, and he's been phenomenal as well. You can't knock him. You can't knock him at all. Very impressive this season. Very impressive.
That's Have you seen much of this guy, Soler, who's been linked
with United? He's been linked with United. Yeah, he's a good little player. Plays like in the number 10 role. Quite nippy, skillful, he's quick. Again, he's young, but why not? Valencia seem to always produce these players. You know, you've got David Silva, Juan Mata. Saying, so, they're renowned for kind of producing these players as well. Santi Mina is another one who's a really good player. The future's promising.
Wasn't Aymar there for a period?
Aymar was there as well, yeah. That's right. And they had their Claudio Lopez up front as well, didn't they?
Kili Gonzalez,
wow. Yeah.
Going back. Right, Adrian, another striker in top form is Inter's Mario Icardi, who bagged a bracing Inter's 2-0 win against Atalanta. This moved them above Juve into second after the champions lost 3-2 at Sampdoria. That was 3-0 down at the time as well. It's becoming a very exciting race for the Scudetto, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And about time, I would say. Juventus have won the last 6 Italian titles. And some of them have been at Cantor. It's been a bit of a procession in the last few years in Italy. So it is nice. I mean, I grew up watching, Italian football on Channel 4, James Richardson and all that. That, you know, some great names. And, you know, every team in Italian football seemed to have 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, big names. Mm. They would stick any team on a Sunday and they'd be worth watching. And that was, I think, when, you know, certainly in my lifetime, Italian football was at its peak. So to see 4 teams in the title race at the moment, and the top 4 separated by 5 points, and not have Juventus at the top of it. You know, Juventus may come good. Obviously, they've got the experience and they've got the quality to do that, but it is nice, and I'm sure they're really enjoying themselves in Italy, actually having a proper title race or the possibility of a proper title race for the first time in a while.
And they haven't lost under Spalletti.
They're unbeaten, yeah. Do you know what? Serie A is such a brilliant league to watch this season.
Yeah.
It's not dull. Teams are going for each other. They're not as defensive as they used to be. That's right.
Things were going to change. The moment the Chinese investors came in, they took over Inter and AC.
Mm.
Roma obviously been challenging for years. Napoli now with Sarri in charge. You know, I said at the beginning of the season, this might be the season where Juventus might actually drop off a little bit, because obviously aging squad, and they didn't really strengthen. Bonucci left. So I don't know, man. You're right. It's a very, very exciting season.
Yeah, I think Napoli-Inter were the only kind of big game that finished 0-0. Apart from that, games of all, even like Roma-Lazio at the weekend, that was another really, it was a passionate derby anyway, but that was a really good game to watch. AC Milan, even with all their problems, they're still good to watch because they can't defend, so there's always goals in their games. And Napoli are scoring goals like anything. They're just a dream, especially Insigne. I'm a massive fan of Insigne. Such a brilliant little player. And like you said, Inter are flying high this year. So it's good.
They've got Fiorentina good. With the 3 second generation.
Yeah.
There you go. So it's a very, very intriguing league. Rod, I was going to ask you for your thoughts on Ajax's 8-0 win against NAC Breda, but I thought you might find CSKA Moscow's away trip to Khabarovsk very interesting.
So that one.
Yeah. Now, for those of you who don't know, the distance between these two teams, 6,500 kilometres. The flight time, 8 hours. Time difference meant kickoff was 7 p.m. local time, which is midday Moscow time. I've been to Moscow. Midnight, sunshine, doesn't make sense. And to add insult to injury, the temperature was around minus 18 degrees. Now, so much for going to Stoke on a wet and windy Wednesday night, mate.
Yeah, when I read that, it was just—it's just bizarre. It was that a league game as well.
League game, yeah, yeah,
Yeah, you just surely they must go a few days before or get time to adjust to the time difference, because that's just or they just fly straight in and spend the night and play. I don't. Yeah, it's a strange one, and especially playing in that kind of weather. Yeah, it'd be difficult. It'd be definitely tight weather.
It's like they're so used to it. It's like,
what do you mean? It's like Brits wearing either a socks and sandals.
Yeah, the tights and the gloves, so they'd definitely be out for that one.
You never heard the Russian coming over here and complaining about the weather, have you?
It's true. It's true. I mean,
Oshov had a brilliant time over here, didn't he?
Yeah, Shevchenko was poor, but I mean, yeah. Like Kanchelskis always wore long sleeves. I don't know why though.
Yeah, might have been his Ukrainian blood.
Come on, not too far.
Yes, right. I know.
Whatever. Yeah, before we go, gents, Rod, a mate of yours was appointed FC United head coach, wasn't he today?
Yeah, Tom Greaves, he's obviously player manager now. Yeah, he's done a fantastic job since he took over, and they've given him the job, and they've given the academy assistant manager Jack Doyle and Tom Conroy assistant manager. So yeah, they've done well. I think they've played 6 games, won 4 and lost 2, but you know, they seem to have turned it around, and so they've given the job today. Yeah, it's good news.
Great stuff. And I don't know if you, because it's a different league, isn't it? That FC United, obviously, in the north, you've got the south with Billy Ricky, with O'Hara and all of those. Mm-hmm. Do you guys talk about them much?
No, not necessarily. I think they're worlds apart, because FC United, you know, they're struggling for money, and Billy Ricky have got money coming out their ears. So I think they're at different scales at the minute. I think Billy Ricky are more towards a bit like Salford, you know, there's lots of cameras and flashes and lots of people around them at the minute. So I think they'll be more suited to each other than FC United and Billy Ricky.
Fair enough. Yeah. Well, gents, it's been an absolute pleasure having you guys on. Thanks, Adrian, for your time, mate. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you very much, mate. Do you want to give our listeners your Twitter handle?
Oh, God, I was going to have to struggle to remember this. Right. Adrian J. Kajumba is my Twitter handle. Capital A, capital J, capital K. I don't know if that makes a difference, but hopefully it does.
There you go. Splendid. Rod?
Rod James Giggs.
Excellent. What about you? 5.1, was it?
Yannickis J, I think it is. I haven't used it for a while. I forgot. No, Yannickis J. Yeah,
I thought he was going by his height then. 5'1".
That's what I said.
5'0", yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, how long have we been going on?
For just over an hour.
It's not been bad. It took an hour. Yeah, it's not bad.
Right, well, we have a Facebook group page. We have a Twitter handle at Shoot the Defence. I haven't used it for a couple of days, actually. I've been slacking. But yeah, before I go, just like to give a quick shout out to FNX Network, the network that we've been on. The figures have been absolutely outstanding recently. I'd just like to thank Ryan and Kane for their support. I'd like to thank My Sportswear, our sponsors, and also Save Association for their continued support. And one more thing, Jay Pino, a good friend of mine who's left his job as a FIFA coach. Would you believe it? There's a FIFA 18 coach, and he's one of them. He could teach me how to play, because I haven't got a clue. You saw me the last time we played. Yeah. I threw the remote control at TV screen.
Yeah,
we won't. He lobbed me from, was it 40 yards with Robert Earnshaw? He should be the next Wales manager. What do you reckon? Right? Robert Earnshaw, he's in Canada.
Yeah, but you checked me with a hatch deal, didn't you?
Yeah, but Jufa's got it in him. He's got it in him. Right, anyway, that's
Gerard's
it.
Best, mate.
Yeah, there you go. That's it for us this week, gents, and everyone listening. Thank you very much for your time. We'll be back sometime next week. Take care.
Take care.